All over, allies, disappointed in the result, swallow their chagrin and get down to business. The year 2016 was different. Donald Trump made clear from the very start that there was no doing business with the vaunted dealmaker. He demanded everything. He offered nothing. Trump was upset at the notion that allies' interests should be taken into account. So Tracy Wilkinson and Brian Bennett reported in the Los Angeles Times in July 2017 about Trump's review of the Iran nuclear deal. The phrase could be applied to almost any foreign policy matter. Foreign leaders quickly perceived that Trump could easily be manipulated, but never reasoned with. On June 5, 2017, four American Arab allies, Bahrain, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, abruptly cut diplomatic ties with a fifth, Qatar. The Saudi bloc accused Qatar of support for terrorism. They suspended Qatar's overflight rights and restricted trade and travel. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani seized the opportunity to wedge apart the pro-American Gulf states, saying, "Iran's airspace, sea, and ground transport links will always be open to Qatar, our brotherly and neighbor country." Qatar's regional ally, Turkey, reinforced its troop presence in the Peninsular Emirate. U.S. intelligence services soon confirmed that Qatar had been the victim of a disinformation campaign by the United Arab Emirates. Karen DeYoung and Ellen Nakashima reported in the Washington Post on July 16, 2017, "The United Arab Emirates orchestrated the hacking of Qatari government news and social media sites in order to post incendiary false quotes attributed to Qatar's emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, in late May, that sparked the ongoing upheaval between Qatar and its neighbors, according to U.S. intelligence officials. Officials became aware last week that newly analyzed information gathered by U.S. intelligence agencies confirmed that on May 23rd, senior members of the UAE government discussed the plan and its implementation. The officials said it remains unclear whether the UAE carried out the hacks itself or contracted to have them done. Given Qatar's importance to Western regional strategy, it houses the largest American base in the Gulf, from which the Pentagon flies anti-ISIS airstrikes, the news of Qatar's innocence should have come as a relief. Only, his head turned by Saudi flattery and gifts, President Trump had already taken a vehement public stand against Qatar. "During my recent trip to the Middle East, I stated that there can no longer be funding of radical ideology. Leaders pointed to Qatar. Look," he tweeted at 8:06 a.m. on June 6, 2017. At 9:36, Trump posted, "So good to see the Saudi Arabia visit with the king and 50 countries already paying off. They said they would take a hard line on funding," adding at 9:44, "Extremism, and all reference was pointing to Qatar. Perhaps this will be the beginning of the end to the horror of terrorism." As Mark Champion and Marek Strzelecki together reported for Bloomberg News on July 19th, United Arab Emirates Foreign Minister Anwar Gargash confirmed this week that Trump's very, very successful trip to the Gulf in May had helped trigger the decision by his country, together with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Bahrain, to launch a political and economic assault on Qatar. President Trump may well not have known Qatar's importance to America's regional military strategy. He surely did know that Qatar's national airline had once been a tenant in New York's Trump Tower, and that it had let the lease lapse in 2014. Worse, Qatar had unwisely held its December 6, 2016 National Day celebration in Washington in the National Portrait Gallery. By contrast, Qatar's rival Bahrain had correctly cited its December 7, 2016 National Day celebration in Trump's Washington, D.C. hotel. Lobbyists for Saudi Arabia had spent $270,000 in the hotel between October 2016 and March 2017. Whatever the motive, the result badly damaged the U.S. strategic position and intensified the world's distrust of America's undisciplined and self-dealing president. The increasingly authoritarian leaders of Poland likewise exploited Trump's inattention and indifference. In Chapter 7, I described Trump's strange indulgence of that government's crackdown on press freedoms during his visit to Warsaw. After Trump departed, the governing party seems to have interpreted his praise for Poland as safe, strong, and free, as permission for another outrage, this time against Poland's courts. The government crammed through two houses of parliament a bill summarily retiring the entire Polish Supreme Court and empowering the governing party's justice minister to name all their successors. Only by mobilizing demonstrations larger than anything since the end of communist rule in 1989 did the liberal opposition compel Poland's president to veto his own party's legislation. The Trump presidency empowered dictators worldwide by dimming American ideals and by hobbling American power. In the first 6 months of 2017, the government of Vietnam arrested 15 people for anti-state activities, more than in any year since 2011. Matthew Tostevin reported for Reuters, "Every activist and analyst that Reuters interviewed mentioned a perceived shift in U.S. priorities under Trump as a new factor in reducing pressure on Vietnam's government. Not only was Washington paying less attention to the region or to human rights, but Trump gave Vietnam less reason to show willingness to address human rights issues when he dropped the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal in the name of an America First policy." No foreign leader manipulated Trump more adeptly than Vladimir Putin. "Why should I tell Putin what to do?" Trump had demanded at a July 27, 2016 press conference. Yet it often seemed that Putin had found a way to tell Trump what to do. Trump's deference to Putin reverberated through the Western alliance. Countries that relied on the United States to protect them from Russia worried that they could rely on America no longer. The leaders of the European allies knew early about Donald Trump's long and disreputable financial connections to Russia. The British had direct access to the U.S. collection of Russians cackling and chortling over their successful penetration of the American election system. The French and Germans and Poles had sources of their own. All could recognize in Donald Trump something much graver than a merely difficult partner. Trump seemed intent on a diplomatic revolution. At the core of this revolution, a presidentially led assault on the cohesion of the European Union. George W. Bush observed in 2003, "Since the end of World War II, the United States has strongly supported European unity as the best path to European peace and prosperity." That was a precisely accurate statement. From Truman through Obama, America's European policy has been strikingly consistent. The United States has supported a democratic and united Europe, joined to Canada and the United States by NATO. We recognize we will benefit more from a strong and equal partner than from a weak one. Those words happen to have been pronounced by Bill Clinton. They could as easily have appeared in a speech by any of his predecessors or successors. Until Trump. Trump has more than once dismissed NATO as obsolete. In an interview at the time of the Republican convention, he repeatedly and forcefully expressed uncertainty about whether, as president, he would honor America's NATO obligations to small countries threatened by Russia. He cheered Britain's exit from the European Union. Trump and his chief campaign strategist, Steve Bannon, made common cause with populist nationalists working to end the European Union outright. President-elect Trump received Nigel Farage, the former leader of the UK Independence Party, before he met British Prime Minister Theresa May. Before Bannon joined the Trump campaign, he promoted the Dutch politician Geert Wilders and France's Marine Le Pen on his Breitbart.com website. Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán claims to have been granted a call with President-elect Trump in November before the President of France spoke to Trump. As president, Trump sharpened his hostility to the European allies. Reuters reported in February on an encounter with Steve Bannon that persuaded Peter Wittig, Germany's ambassador to the United States, to prepare for a policy of hostility towards the EU. Ambassador Wittig proved prescient. You have to think about it this way. We are in a trade war. We have been for decades. So said Trump's Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, on CNBC on March 31, 2017. Secretary Ross did not specify America's enemies in that war, but his frequent co-author Peter Navarro, appointed by President Trump to head a newly created National Trade Council, identified Germany as one of them. Germany is one of the most difficult trade deficits that we're going to have to deal with, but we're thinking long and hard about that, said Navarro in a March 6, 2017 speech. Trump's diplomacy reserved its smiles for non-democracies that offered commercial opportunities, not only in the Persian Gulf and the Philippines, but even in the case of as bad an actor as Recep Erdogan's Turkey, also home to a major Trump-branded project in Istanbul. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson visited Turkey on July 15, 2017, the one-year anniversary of an attempted coup that the Erdogan regime had used as an excuse for mass roundups of political opponents, and especially journalists. In April 2017, a fraud-stained referendum had approved constitutional amendments that would empower Erdogan to rule for life. Yet Tillerson had this to say at Erdogan's self-honoring anniversary ceremony. "We're all here in Istanbul at a momentous time. Nearly a year ago, the Turkish people, brave men and women, stood up against coup plotters and defended their democracy." New friendships sought among dictatorships. Old friendships burned among democracies. That was the product of thinking long and hard. The key element of this long and hard thought, a new refusal by the Trump administration to respect the European Union's 2007 treaty agreement to adopt a common external trade policy. In consequence, EU member nations no longer field their own trade negotiators, a fact that President Trump steadfastly refused to acknowledge. "The negotiators for Germany have done a far better job than the negotiators for the United States," Trump said at a March 18, 2017 joint press conference in Washington. "But hopefully we can even it out." Merkel reminded him at that same press conference, "The European Union is negotiating those agreements for all of the member states." Trump often revealed ignorance of basic facts about the international order, but something more than ignorance was at work here. In his March speech, Navarro had explicitly cited Germany's EU treaty commitments as a flimsy excuse the United States would ignore under President Trump. "I think that it would be useful to have candid discussions with Germany about ways that we could possibly get that deficit reduced outside of the boundaries and restrictions that they claim they are under. Emphasis mine." President Trump returned to the theme on Twitter on May 30, 2017, writing, "We have a massive trade deficit with Germany. Plus, they pay far less than they should on NATO and military. Very bad for U.S. This will change." By then, though, something else had changed, too. At a major speech in Munich on May 28, 2017, 10 days after her first bilateral meeting with Trump, Merkel had brought down the curtain on an epoch in U.S.-Germany relations. Speaking in her characteristically careful style, the Chancellor delivered a warning to Germans and Americans alike. "The times when we could completely rely on others are, to an extent, over. I experienced that in the last few days, and therefore I can only say that we Europeans must really take our fate into our own hands, of course in friendship with the United States and in friendship with Great Britain and as good neighbors wherever it is possible, also with Russia and also with all the other countries. But we need to know that we have to fight for our own future and destiny as Europeans." This is precisely what Trump rejected. Past American presidents heralded a more united Europe as a counterweight to the Soviet Union and then Russia. A united Europe would be a superpower in its own right, with a population more than triple that of Russia and an economy more than 12 times as large. Trump resented European unity because it also enhanced European power as against the United States. Trump interpreted international affairs as he interpreted everything, as a struggle for dominance, never cooperation among equals. In a February 2017 address to CPAC, Trump expressed plainly his vision of a world economy in which America domineered over a subservient planet. "We are going to make trade deals, but we're going to do one-on-one, one-on-one, and if they misbehave, we terminate the deal. And then they'll come back and we'll make a better deal. None of these big quagmire deals that are a disaster." The beauty of one-on-one deals, from Trump's point of view, is that in such deals, the United States, for the foreseeable future, will almost always overawe its counterparty. It can impose one-sided terms, act as judge and jury in its own cause, demand endless revisions in its own favor. The Americans and friends of America who built the post-1945 world order foresaw the temptation to abuse American dominance. They had fought a terrible war against would-be global empires. They repudiated constructing one of their own. They keenly appreciated America's unique power and unrivaled wealth. They understood that these advantages would diminish over time. They deliberately built a world system that accorded large and small states more equality of respect than ever before in world history. They designed trade and treaty systems governed by rules, rules to which the United States would submit like any other country. Indeed, they intended exactly the things that Donald Trump now complains about, that the United States would have to make concessions to smaller partners, that it would not act as judge in its own cases, that it would subordinate its parochial and immediate national interests to the larger and more enduring collective interest. America would find its own security by working for the security of others. Americans accepted a new world order that constrained their own power in part because they were accustomed to such constraints at home. The U.S. Constitution likewise overweights smaller states and rural minorities against urban majorities. But they had also learned from the catastrophes of world history. It is dangerous for any state, no matter how strong, to attempt to subordinate all others. Selfish hegemons from the Habsburg Emperor Charles V to the Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin summoned up coalitions to topple them, and no single state could ever prevail against so many adversaries. In the world, as at home, systems that serve the interests of all endure better than systems that oppress many to serve a few. Upholding that system has become even more challenging since the end of the Cold War. American allies feel less frightened of Russia, more attracted by the opportunities of a rising China, and less accepting of American actions they dislike, from the Iraq War to electronic surveillance. Germans acclaim Obama now, but after the Snowden revelations of 2014, the German government expelled the CIA station chief in Berlin, a shocking action by a NATO partner. Whoever became president in 2016 would need extraordinary vision and tact to manage a more refractory world system, one in which year by year the United States and its core allies counted for less, and China, India, and other emerging economies counted for more. Instead, the United States stumbled into a presidency determined to smash that system. Trump hoped that an unconstrained America could grab more power for itself and thereby for him. He never understood that America's power arose not only from its own wealth and its own military force, but from its centrality to a network of friends and allies. During the election cycle, external observers of American politics often wondered and sharply pressed anyone they regarded as a DC insider whether there might be some method to Trump's madness. Did his outbursts and tirades, disconcerting as they were, perhaps follow some shrewd strategy? After Election Day, the hunt for Trump's logic naturally intensified. It did not take long for that search to be abandoned as futile. Receiving Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, in the Oval Office in mid-May, Trump blurted a crucial counterterrorism secret entrusted to the United States by a regional ally. Greg Miller and Greg Jaffe reported for The Washington Post on May 15, 2017. In his meeting with Lavrov, Trump seemed to be boasting about his inside knowledge of the looming threat. "I get great intel. I have people brief me on great intel every day," the president said, according to an official with knowledge of the exchange. Trump went on to discuss aspects of the threat that the United States learned only through the espionage capabilities of a key partner. He did not reveal the specific intelligence-gathering method, but he described how the Islamic State was pursuing elements of a specific plot and how much harm such an attack could cause under varying circumstances. Most alarmingly, officials said, Trump revealed the city in the Islamic State's territory where the U.S. intelligence partner detected the threat. From that point on, speculation about Trump's secret strategy almost entirely ceased. More and more, he looks like a complete moron, a veteran of Trump's presidential campaign grouse to the Daily Beast. Moron or no, Trump remained the president and still wielded the vast power of that office, or anyway could do so on days he bothered to show up, pay attention, and make decisions. This fact could not be ignored or elided. If a Donald Trump presidency could happen, anything could happen. American words could no longer be trusted. American reactions no longer predicted. If, as seemed increasingly possible, Trump had been helped into the presidency by a Russian intelligence operation, then the ultimate guarantor of the whole world order had revealed a system-shaking vulnerability, as if the Red Cross could not manage a blood bank, as if the Federal Reserve had run out of dollars. Every international actor, benign or malign, had to take the new information into account. America's friends might hope that the Trump presidency would prove short, its activities limited and ineffectual. They could count the months and minutes until a return to something more like normal. But things could never wholly return to normal again, could they? Long after Donald Trump retires to the great golf club in the sky, prudent allies will remember what the Trump presidency revealed about the American political system, and not just the single man who held that office. In a 2014 speech, Trump's future political advisor Steve Bannon proposed Vladimir Putin as the true leader of a new kind of global conservative movement. Bannon is a vague and discursive talker who habitually attributes his own thoughts to unnamed others, so it's necessary to quote him at some length. At least Putin is standing up for traditional institutions, and he's trying to do it in a form of nationalism, and I think that people, particularly in certain countries, want to see the sovereignty for their country. They want to see nationalism for their country. They don't believe in this kind of pan-European Union, or they don't believe in the centralized government in the United States. They'd rather see more of a states-based entity that the founders originally set up, where freedoms were controlled at the local level. We, the Judeo-Christian West, really have to look at what he's, Putin, talking about as far as traditionalism goes, particularly the sense of where it supports the underpinnings of nationalism. And I happen to think that the individual sovereignty of a country is a good thing and a strong thing. I think strong countries and strong nationalist movements in countries make strong neighbors, and that is really the building blocks that built Western Europe and the United States, and I think that's what can see us forward. You know, Putin's been quite an interesting character. He's also very, very, very intelligent. I can see this in the United States, where he's playing very strongly to social conservatives about his message about more traditional values. The conservative journalist Chris Caldwell articulated a more lucid explication of Bannon's 2014 message at Hillsdale College in February 2017. So why are people thinking about Putin as much as they do? Because he has become a symbol of national self-determination. Populist conservatives see him the way progressives once saw Fidel Castro, as the one person who says he won't submit to the world that surrounds him. You didn't have to be a communist to appreciate the way Castro, whatever his excesses, was carving out a space of autonomy for his country. In the same way, Putin's conduct is bound to win sympathy even from some of Russia's enemies, the ones who feel the international system is not delivering for them. Generally, if you like that system, you will consider Vladimir Putin a menace. If you don't like it, you will have some sympathy for him. Putin has become a symbol of national sovereignty in its battle with globalism. That turns out to be the big battle of our times. In that battle, if battle is the right metaphor, Donald Trump has aligned with Putin against almost all of America's most important allies. And the U.S. national security apparatus has demonstrated an incapacity to constrain or moderate him. Vivian Salama of the Associated Press reported in mid-July 2017, "Deep divisions are increasingly apparent within the administration on the best way to approach Moscow in the midst of U.S. investigations into Russian meddling in the American presidential election. Trump has repeatedly cast doubt on the conclusion of U.S. intelligence agencies that the Russian government sought to tip the election in his favor, and has dismissed investigations into the possibility of collusion between his campaign and Moscow as a witch hunt. Meanwhile, he has pushed for cooperation between Moscow and Washington on various matters, including the raging conflict in Syria. But some top aides, including National Security Advisor General H.R. McMaster, have been warning that Putin is not to be trusted. One U.S. official said, "Diplomats and intelligence officials were dumbfounded by the president's approach." The dumbfounding only accelerated from there. Days previous to that AP report, Greg Jaffe and Adam Entis broke the news in the Washington Post that the Trump administration had terminated aid to CIA-backed anti-Assad forces inside Syria. The Trump administration had signaled this decision in late March 2017 when it announced that it would no longer demand the ouster of the Syrian dictator, Bashar al-Assad, a reversal not only of Obama administration policy but of a long-standing Republican congressional demand. "Assad must go," insisted Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at a press conference in April 2017. "I don't see how there can possibly be any settlement in Syria that includes Bashar al-Assad. I just can't imagine, after all the butchering of his own people that he's been doing now for 4 or 5 years, that there could be any successful conclusion to this chaos with him still there." "Assad must go," read the headline on an April 2017 press release from Ed Royce, the Republican chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. With more than 480,000 people killed by the regime and 14 million driven from their homes, it is clear there is no hope for real peace in Syria until Assad is held accountable. "Assad must go," had declared a group of Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Florida's Marco Rubio, Colorado's Cory Gardner, Oklahoma's James Lankford, and Tennessee's Bob Corker, the committee's chairman. "Assad must go," agreed two Republicans on the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain and Tom Cotton. "Assad's crimes against humanity cannot go unanswered," declared House Speaker Paul Ryan in a May 2017 statement. "The United States of America should be prepared to use military force to strike military targets of the Assad regime," intoned Mike Pence in the October 2016 vice presidential debate. Against this overwhelming party consensus, Trump imposed a policy about-face. "This is a momentous decision. Putin won in Syria," said one of the Washington Post's sources on the policy reversal. The regulars lost on staffing, too. The former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had chosen as his deputy K.T. McFarland, a Fox News host who had last served in government in the 1980s, as a speechwriter to Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger. Bloomberg reported in early April that Flynn's replacement, H.R. McMaster, had forced McFarland out, banishing her 9,700 miles and 8 time zones away to the ambassadorship to Singapore. 3 months later, McFarland was still in Washington, still coming to work at the NSC. Trump appointed as a counterterrorism advisor Sebastian Gorka, a Breitbart blogger who pleaded guilty in August 2016 to attempting to board a flight at Reagan Airport with a gun in his carry-on bag. It took almost 9 months for H.R. McMaster and Chief of Staff John Kelly to dispense with Gorka's services to the United States. The most disturbing personality in the Trump national security system, however, was always Trump himself. Enraged by information that law enforcement agencies had surveilled his campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, President Trump emitted a bizarre sequence of tweets on March 4, 2017. Trump alleged that former President Obama had ordered listening devices installed to monitor Trump himself. How low has President Obama gone to tap my phones during the very sacred election process? This is Nixon Watergate stuff. Bad or sick guy. In an effort to substantiate Trump's wild and false claims, Press Secretary Sean Spicer repeated at the White House briefing podium an assertion by a Fox News personality that Britain's signal agency, GCHQ, had carried out the tapping at Obama's behest. That assertion was in turn based on rumors circulated on Russian television and pro-Moscow websites. An obviously embarrassed Spicer raced through a mumbled reading of the allegation. However miserably Spicer felt about it, he dutifully hurled the false and alliance-damaging accusation from behind the Great Seal of the United States. In a September 1, 2017 court filing, the Trump Department of Justice would formally acknowledge that the president's accusation of taps had been baseless from the start. Both FBI and NSD, the National Security Division within the FBI, confirm that they have no records related to wiretaps as described by the March 4, 2017 tweets. But if Trump was not tapped, his future campaign chair, Paul Manafort, apparently had been surveilled, for reasons most likely arising from Manafort's work for the pro-Russian regime in Ukraine, overthrown in 2014. That surveillance may have swept up conversations with candidate Trump. How were allies to interpret all this? A president caught in surveillance because he had accepted pro bono campaign services from the same operative who had previously served Putin's man in Kiev. Something had obviously gone terribly wrong inside the American national security apparatus. That apparatus abruptly seemed largely powerless to protect itself, much less friends and allies. What choice did those allies and friends have except to make their own new arrangements for a world in which the United States could no longer be trusted? In which the President of the United States seemed at best a destructive incompetent, at worst an outright Russian intelligence asset. The wrongness sank deeper than national strategy, deeper than military affairs, deeper than staff and secrets. The wrongness seemed to have darkened and distorted the very idea of America to the rest of the world. Early in 1990, in the joyous months after the collapse of the communist regimes of Central Europe, Czechoslovakia's president, Václav Havel, addressed a joint session of Congress. To explain the past and future of his own country, the great writer interwove a long meditation on what the United States had meant to Europe and the world. "Wasn't it the best minds of your country, people you could call intellectuals, who wrote your famous Declaration of Independence, your Bill of Human Rights, and your Constitution, and who, above all, took upon themselves practical responsibility for putting them into practice? Those great documents inspire us all. They inspire us despite the fact that they are over 200 years old. They inspire us to be citizens." Which Democratic ally would address the United States Congress in such terms in the Trump era? The government of the United States seems to have made common cause with the planet's thugs, crooks, and dictators against its own ideals, and, in fact, to have imported the spirit of thuggery, crookedness, and dictatorship into the very core of the American state, into the most solemn symbolic oval center of its law and liberty. The man inside that oval center did not act alone. He held his power with the connivance of others. They executed his orders and empowered his whims for crass and cowardly reasons of their own. Partisanship, ambition, greed for gain, eagerness for attention, ideological zeal, careerist conformity, or, in the worst cases, malicious glee in the wreck of things they could never have built themselves. They claim the symbols of the Republic as they subvert its institutions. They pin the flag to their lapels before commencing the day's work of lying, obstructing, and corrupting. They speak for America to a world that remembers a different and better America. But that memory is already fading into a question of whether it was not perhaps always an illusion, whether this new regime of deceit and brutishness will not only form the future, but whether it also, retrospectively, discredits the American past. Chapter 9. Autoimmune Disorder. If the national security apparatus could not constrain President Trump, neither would it go down without a struggle. Trump had the power of the presidency, his bureaucratic opponents the weapon of the leak. No administration has ever been so perforated by leaks as Donald Trump's. As the joke went, it fell to Donald Trump to deliver on Barack Obama's promise of the most transparent administration ever. Those leaks thwarted many of the worst impulses of the new Trump administration. Leaks swiftly removed from office Trump's profoundly compromised first choice for national security advisor, Michael Flynn. Leaks alerted the world that President Trump had blabbed a crucial military secret to the Russian foreign minister. Leaks deterred the Trump administration from lifting sanctions on Russia as soon as it entered office, as Michael Isakoff reported for Yahoo News in June 2017. In the early weeks of the Trump administration, former Obama administration officials and State Department staffers fought an intense behind-the-scenes battle to head off efforts by incoming officials to normalize relations with Russia, according to multiple sources familiar with the events. Unknown to the public at the time, top Trump administration officials, almost as soon as they took office, tasked State Department staffers with developing proposals for the lifting of economic sanctions, the return of diplomatic compounds, and other steps to relieve tensions with Moscow. These efforts to relax or remove punitive measures imposed by President Obama in retaliation for Russia's intervention in Ukraine and meddling in the 2016 election alarmed some State Department officials, who immediately began lobbying congressional leaders to quickly pass legislation to block the move, the sources said. Yet the same leaks that thwarted Trump's pro-Putin agenda also exacted a heavy price. Those leaks revealed U.S. surveillance capabilities in a way that compromised national security. For example, Greg Miller, Adam Entus, and Ellen Nakashima broke in the February 9, 2017 Washington Post News that Flynn had lied when he denied speaking to Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak about sanctions relief. Nine current and former officials who were in senior positions at multiple agencies at the time of the calls spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss intelligence matters. All of those officials said Flynn's references to the election-related sanctions were explicit. Two of those officials went further, saying that Flynn urged Russia not to overreact to the penalties being imposed by President Barack Obama, making clear that the two sides would be in position to review the matter after Trump was sworn in as president. Kislyak was left with the impression that the sanctions would be revisited at a later time, said a former official. Kislyak, being no novice and no fool, would have conducted his conversations with Flynn by some modality he regarded as safe from American surveillance. In order to expose Flynn's lie, the nine officials who talked to the Post also revealed to the Russians that the United States had cracked a link that Russian intelligence operatives had regarded as secure. It had to be assumed that the Russian embassy would immediately alter its communications methods, denying the United States future information flows at least for some period of time. To protect the United States from a compromised national security advisor, 9 senior intelligence officials agreed to burn an important American national secret. Such trade-offs would occur again and again. As noted in the previous chapter, Trump blurted an important secret to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in the Oval Office on May 10, 2017. Trump's boastful blabbermouthery was bad for many reasons, but on its own, the blurt may have done only limited harm. The secret purportedly exposed an Israeli penetration of ISIS communications. The Russians might have shared that information with their clients inside Syria and their partners in Iran. But would any of those actors, Russia, Iran, or the Assad regime, have shared the information with ISIS? Perhaps ISIS in turn has penetrated the Assad regime. Still, all those risks were more roundabout than what happened next. The possible divulgence of the substance of the secret to the news media by disgusted national security professionals. I've used hedged language here because it is not impossible that the secondary round of leaks consisted of deliberate disinformation from national security professionals, frantically trying to minimize the harm of the president's mistake. Even if the round two leaks were disinformation, however, the revelation, as legitimately public-spirited as it was, inflicted yet another harm. A president, any president, would normally expect his staff to protect the confidentiality of his deliberations, including the inevitable mistakes that any human being will make. The goofs, gaffes, grievances, lapses of memory, political incorrectnesses, and remarks best not repeated outside this room that have echoed off the walls of government ever since those walls were erected. Donald Trump says more things that should not be said than any president in American history, but also, more than any president in history, he works in an office he cannot trust and knows he cannot trust. Donald Trump may not be a proper president or a competent president or a patriotic president or even a legitimate president in any larger ethical sense of the word legitimate, but he is the lawful president charged with public functions. In order to stop him from betraying his office and the country, the professionals around him have also effectively prevented him from fulfilling his office and serving his country, supposing he were ever minded to do that. He must do his job however he conceives that job, within a narrow ambit of relatives and cronies, selected mostly for their negative qualities, their lack of knowledge, their lack of experience, their lack of independence, their lack of integrity. The dysfunction inside the White House is Trump's fault, but it is not only Trump's problem. The executive office of the president has, until now, almost always been staffed by committed people who take their jobs highly seriously. There are few slackers at a White House. The smallest jobs must be done with the greatest care. A future election can turn on whether the president has offended a local notable by mispronouncing her husband's name. The Trump White House is a mess of careless slobs. At the highest levels, one sees mutual sabotage, easily decoded on-background name-calling, false filings of disclosure documents, and institutionalized lying about readily ascertainable facts. The failure of leadership at the top contaminates the whole enterprise. Even the most routine work product of the Trump White House is strewn with errors of spelling, fact, and protocol, sometimes of quite serious consequence. Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star compiled a list of some 30 such goofs. The funniest was perhaps a July 12th release attacking the accuracy of the Congressional Budget Office that misspelled the word inaccurately as I-N-N accurately. The most serious was a July 8th reference to China's Xi Jinping as President of the Republic of China, the Republic of China being the official name of Taiwan, of course. Along the way, the Trump White House misspelled not only the names of many of its own newly appointed officials, but also that of the Prime Minister of Great Britain. In a primetime television address in August 2017 about his decision to escalate the U.S. commitment to Afghanistan, President Trump described that country's prime minister as its president. More bafflingly, on October 1, 2017, the official spokesperson for the Department of State assured the world via Twitter that North Korea would never attain the nuclear capability it had in fact attained in 2006. At best, the dysfunction of the Trump team has actively advanced the public interest by unintentionally thwarting the Trump administration's more sinister instincts. But at worst, the casual incompetence has risked authentic harm. During the visit of Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to the United States in February 2017, Trump received word of a North Korean missile test while dining on the patio at his Mar-a-Lago club. Rather than withdraw into the secure communications area established for a president wherever he may go, Trump read a report on the situation on the spot, illuminating his reading by the lights of aides' cell phones, a shocking security breach. Because mobile phones can so easily be hacked and converted into spy cameras, it's not permitted even to bring them into a secure facility, much less to point them at a sensitive document. Not only did Trump ignore that rule, so did the half-dozen aides who crowded around him in the photographs snapped by other diners and posted on Facebook. By the time of the May meeting with Lavrov, these egregious departures from basic operational security had been curbed to the public benefit. If Trump were not so locked into a tiny circle by his distrust of outsiders, his handling of healthcare reform might also have amounted to less of a fiasco. Trump started as something like a moderate on the healthcare issue. He has praised the universal systems of Canada and the United Kingdom, promised broader coverage, and defended Medicaid against criticism from the Congressional Party. It's easily imaginable that a more professional policy process inside the White House would have enabled him to triangulate against both Congressional Democrats and Republicans, arriving at a position broadly acceptable to much of public opinion. Given Trump's extreme ignorance of healthcare issues, however, such a plan would require bringing aboard some authentic nonpartisan experts who could draft a policy consistent with Trump's own surprisingly generous instincts on the issue. But by the time the healthcare debate was reaching its peak, FBI Director Comey had been fired, a special counsel, Robert Mueller, had been appointed, and the Trump White House had immured itself for siege. Welcoming somebody with no special loyalty to Trump into the council of such an embattled president? Impossible and unthinkable. This enabled the do-or-die House Republicans under Speaker Ryan to hornswoggle a president with no particular commitment to their ideology into subscribing to the most crushingly unpopular item on their agenda. The pattern would repeat itself on tax reform. Trump allowed congressional Republicans to write a tax plan that delivered little or nothing to his own constituencies within the party. Trump relied heavily for advice on a Treasury secretary so politically tone-deaf that he had sought a government plane to transport him around Europe on a 3-week honeymoon. A more modest revision of the notorious inefficiency of the corporate income tax might well have gained bipartisan support. John Kerry had endorsed corporate tax reform in 2004. Instead, Trump committed himself to yet another shove-it-through plan that left him hostage to any three nervous Republican senators. I am not suggesting here that Trump was a victim of anything or anyone other than himself. There were sound reasons for professionals of all kinds to keep a far distance from the Trump White House. Some 40 people were indicted as a result of the Watergate scandal. Among those sentenced to prison, the Attorney General of the United States, the White House Counsel, and President Nixon's two most senior White House aides. A dozen men were convicted or pleaded guilty to a range of charges after the Iran-Contra affair. White Houses can be dangerous places under leadership that does not respect the law. Official lying is usually unethical, but not always illegal, until suddenly the official is called before a congressional committee or federal investigation. Then he or she must choose either to confess the lie or repeat it under oath. The terms of service in the Trump White House were not only dishonorable and humiliating, but also dangerous. people with sense and people with options preferred to stay away. Trump's abuse of the power of the presidency invited reciprocal abuses by members of other branches of government. When President Trump banned travelers from certain Muslim-majority nations from entering the United States, he was exercising a lawful power of his office. It's well-established law that the president has power to bar any class of aliens, both as immigrants and as non-immigrants, and to impose on their ordinary comings and goings any restrictions he may deem appropriate. Some argued that Trump violated the Constitution by imposing a restriction that disadvantaged adherents of one religion from traveling to the United States. But the Constitution applies only to Americans. The Supreme Court ruled as recently as 2015 that the president could deny a visa to an alien for no stated reason at all. Aliens have no due process rights against the United States, and no First Amendment rights against the United States. Yet the courts have shredded Trump's travel ban anyway. In the words of the first of a series of federal judges to rule against the Trump administration, the courts could not overlook significant and unrebutted evidence of religious animus driving the promulgation of the executive order and its related predecessor. To amend an old saying, bad presidents make bad law. Because President Trump behaved in what the courts regarded as a wrongful way, the courts responded in ways they would have regarded as wrongful only 12 months before. For it was not only one judge in Hawaii who stripped Trump of previous presidential powers. The travel ban litigation would snake its way through the Ninth Circuit to the Supreme Court, the Trump administration losing at almost every step of the way. In July 2017, the Supreme Court would uphold the administration's rights to reduce the intake of previously accepted refugees. In the travel ban litigation, the courts asserted a new power to disregard long-established and long-accepted formal law if the president's personal words created a basis for mistrusting his motives. In response to the danger posed by Trump, other holders of American power are tempted to jettison their historic role too, and to use any tool at hand, no matter how doubtfully legitimate, to stop him. In order to save the constitutional system, its defenders are at risk of corroding it. Nowhere is that risk more acute than in the realm of civilian-military relations, and from two directions. The first directional risk is the movement of the military into government. Barack Obama appointed one former general, Eric Shinseki, to his cabinet to lead the Department of Veteran Affairs, and another, David Petraeus, to head the Central Intelligence Agency. George W. Bush appointed one as well, Colin Powell, as Secretary of State. Bill Clinton appointed a general, Barry McCaffrey, as Director of the Office of Drug Control Policy, and an admiral, William J. Crow, as his first ambassador to the United Kingdom. Retired and active generals have more than once held the job of National Security Advisor. Brent Scowcroft under George H.W. Bush, Colin Powell under Ronald Reagan. Never before, however, had a president concentrated anything near so much power in former military hands as Donald Trump did. The National Security Act of 1947 expressly forbids active or recently retired generals from serving as the Secretary of Defense. The ban was waived only once before, in September 1950, to permit George C. Marshall to reorganize the U.S. Armed Forces, which were demoralized after their humiliating retreat down the Korean Peninsula. No such emergency existed in 2017, but Trump asked for and got a second waiver to appoint James Mattis as Secretary of Defense. Trump appointed the retired General John Kelly as Homeland Security Secretary, and his ally, the retired General Michael Flynn, as National Security Advisor. When Flynn was forced to resign, Trump offered the post to a retired admiral, Bob Harward. Harward declined because Trump would not allow him to remove Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner from the NSC Principals Committee. Trump next turned to General H.R. McMaster, who, as an active duty officer, could not refuse. Another general, Keith Kellogg, was awkwardly inserted alongside the "No, I won't go," K.T. McFarland, as a second deputy national security advisor. John Kelly would replace Reince Priebus as White House Chief of Staff on July 28, 2017. President Trump even appointed a former general to head the Federal Bureau of Prisons. These are all honorable and capable men. The United States is lucky to have their service, but it's unprecedented and troubling to concentrate so many former military people into any administration. In this administration, the concentration sounds even louder warnings. The non-generals in high office in the Trump administration were a worryingly weak group. Chris Ruddy, the CEO of Newsmax, emerged from a February 2017 visit with the president to disparage Chief of Staff Priebus to the Washington Post. "I think on paper, Reince looked good as the Chief of Staff, and Donald trusted him, but it's pretty clear the guy is in way over his head. He's not knowledgeable of how federal agencies work, how the communications operations work." Trump's standing Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, was weakened by a troubling Russia history of his own. In July 2017, the U.S. Treasury Department issued a stinging assessment of Tillerson's former employer. ExxonMobil demonstrated reckless disregard for U.S. sanctions requirements. ExxonMobil caused significant harm to the Ukraine-related sanctions program. In light of the severity of those words, the comparatively light fine of $2 million raised yet more questions about Tillerson's role inside government and out. Even without that backstory, Tillerson would have been diminished by President Trump's evident disregard for him and his own systematic deconstruction of the department he headed. As late as mid-summer 2017, the Trump administration had not submitted nominations for the assistant secretaryships of Eurasian and East Asian Affairs, for Near Eastern or African Affairs, for Chief of Protocol, for Chief Counselor, or for its top counterterrorism and non-proliferation jobs. Despite crises in Spain and South Korea, the United States had no ambassador in either country as of October 1, 2017. There was not even a state White House liaison, which may explain how nobody noticed that Republic of China mistake. In a government so weak and mismanaged, the competence of its former military personnel exerted even more gravity than otherwise, which might have been a mercy. Who wouldn't prefer that the United States be led by James Mattis than Donald Trump? But for this fact, military men, like people trained to any demanding specialty, acquire certain habits of mind, certain ways of looking at the world. Within a well-functioning administration, this perspective is enriching. Within an administration like Donald Trump's, it can be supremely dangerous. High among those dangers is impatience with law. Military people are selected, trained, and promoted to get results. There are no wrong ways to win a battle, after all. Procedures and protocols are all very well in their way, but to the military mind, they can never be and never should be ends in themselves. Nobody should want to change that outlook, but that outlook, good in its place, must always be balanced in a republic of laws by the lawyer's insistence on the supremacy of legality. The most wrenching post-Watergate scandal, Iran-Contra, was the work of three military men who refused to heed this insistence: John Poindexter, Bud McFarlane, and Oliver North. Unlike the Watergate burglars, these men aimed only at the public good as they understood it. To the extent that the trammels of the law impeded them, they sliced through them as so much irritating and unnecessary red tape. Under a president who despises law even more than the most impatient general, a general's instincts become even more dangerous to him, to the government, and to the nation. Vice President Pence enjoined the 2017 graduating class at the U.S. Naval Academy to follow the chain of command without exception. Submit yourselves, as the saying goes, to the authorities that have been placed above you. Trust your superiors, trust your orders, and you'll serve and lead well. But that is not the American way. American officers are bound to obey only lawful orders. The unthinking obedience recommended by the vice president is the mentality of authoritarian states, not rule-of-law societies. 10 years after the ratification of the Constitution, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected forever the "I was just following orders" defense.